ESVS Podcasts. I am Laurence Bertrand, and this is an Editor's Choice episode. Today, we will take an in-depth look at an article presenting machine learning-based prediction of post-EVAR type 1 endoleaks by looking at infrarenal endograft apposition on abdominal aortic aneurysm neck. It is an open-access article published in the European Journal of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery in November 2024 by Dr. Van Veldhuizen et al. This paper presents a prediction model using the preoperative CT scans and analysis of the pararenal aortic shape variation to predict patients to have an above or below 10 mm predicted shortest apposition neck with an accuracy of 77%, ultimately aiming to predict type 1A endoleaks after EVAR. With us today, we are honored to have Dr. Van Veldhuizen herself for a first-hand account of this research. She is finishing her PhD in vascular and trauma surgery and currently working as a postdoc at the University Medical Center of Groningen, the Netherlands. Welcome to the ESVS podcast and congratulations on the creation and publication of this important work.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very honored to discuss this study with you on this podcast today.
First, I would like to ask, how did this research come about? I see that alongside vascular and trauma surgery authors from the University Medical Center of Groningen, there are some co-authors from the Applied Mathematics Department at the University of Twente Enschede, Netherlands. That must have been quite an enriching collaboration.
That was definitely an enriching collaboration. When I started my PhD, the promotion team discussed options to collaborate with more technically oriented researchers, because we have some studies within my PhD that are more technical. And since I'm a biomedical engineer myself, I really appreciated the expertise and knowledge that were brought into these projects by the researchers of the University of Twente.
So before we get into the article and the development and testing of this model, could you explain to us how is it different from other traditional statistical models and why do you call it machine learning?
The idea behind this project was to investigate if preoperative 3D shape information was informative to estimate the apposition length postoperatively. And this 3D shape information was obtained using a so-called statistical shape model. And we trained some commonly used classification models to gain insight if it would be even possible to predict the shortest apposition length. These common classification models are called machine learning because these algorithms automatically learn complex patterns from the data we gave to it, and they are able to make predictions for new and unseen cases.
So because the cases that you're putting in afterwards were not included in the model, that's the reason you would be able to call it machine learning. Is that right?
Yes, partly that's one of the features of machine learning. Yes, it can make estimations on data that it's not trained on.
Right. Yeah. The stated aim of the study was to, and I quote, develop a model to predict post-operative shortest apposition length in patient with abdominal aortic aneurysm based on the preoperative shape. For our listeners, the shortest apposition length is defined in the study as the shortest length of circumferential apposition with the aortic wall. Is this the same as proximal landing zone? If not, what's the difference?
The main difference is that the proximal landing zone is that zone within the aortic wall where you would like to achieve apposition. So it's a preoperative situation, whereas the real achieved apposition surface is that surface that was actually achieved postoperatively, so where the endograft seals with the aortic wall. And then the shortest apposition length is the shortest length along that real achieved apposition surface.
Thank you for clarifying. The output of the model is a binary result. The model is designed to use the patient's preoperative CT to predict an either above or below 10 millimeters shortest apposition length postoperatively. Is that correct? And could you explain why you chose this measurement as your output and why the result is binary around 10 millimeters? I mean, presumably it would be even more valuable to create a model that tells us what the apposition may be. Is that information not available, or did we feel that was less useful?
Well, I think its project should be regarded as a first step to actually go towards a maybe even a virtual stenting tool, so to see where apposition will be achieved. And it's a little bit harder to train models to actually predict a value for the shortest apposition length. We were also working on this, or actually we're currently working on this, But as we also know from research from colleagues in the field, is that if you have lower apposition than 10 millimeters, it's associated with higher risk of developing type 1A and leak. So that's why we chose as a first step to create classification models. They are always by definition a binary output, and that's why we chose the cutoff value of 10 millimeters.
I understand. Thank you. Let's go into some details of the model creation. You described two sets of post-EVAR patients who were included, 93 without complications and 54 who developed a late endoleak, judged by two experienced CT readers independently as type 1A. Cases with doubt as to the origin of the leak were excluded, and preoperative CTs and early postoperative, that is within 6 weeks CTs, were put into the model. Is that correct? Can you elaborate on this?
Mainly that's correct. So the preoperative CT data, or actually the 3D shape information gained from these CT and oversizing, were used as input for the models. And we trained on the apposition length that was obtained from the first postoperative CT. So it was the apposition length was the what we trained for, but was not used as input into the models.
So one exclusion criteria that is described is patients who had intentionally short landing zones. So where the surgeon preoperatively knew we're going to have a landing zone that is less than 5 millimeter. However, obviously, these are the cases that are precisely more likely to develop type 1A endoleaks. Do you see a risk of selection bias here?
I think I want to clarify a little bit on this exclusion criteria, because what we did here, and was also because of the retrospective nature of my study, was not something I could change myself. So this was exclusion or inclusion criteria already defined prior to my studies. But what I want to highlight here is that we excluded patients who had an intentionally lower placement, so more than 5 millimeters below the renal artery. So it does not necessarily need to be a small landing zone, but if you would look at just from a geometrical perspective, you would have had a higher apposition length if you would have placed it a little bit higher. But the choice of the surgeon was made to place it a little bit lower. And I think for both ways, whether or not to in or exclude them, there would be a risk of selection bias. But based from a geometrical perspective, I think it's more valid to not include them in this prediction model.
Because the geometric analysis is based on the pararenal aorta. And so therefore, the extent that is placed 5 milliliters below will not be applicable to this model. Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah, I think it's mainly because if you would provide such cases like the geometrical information to the model, it will almost always predict high apposition length because you would have more room to actually use or to place a stent. And actually, the postoperative one is always lower. So you would always have a wrong prediction, even though if you just look at the geometrical perspective, I think we would underestimate the prediction performance of the models if we would include them. But these are actually quite interesting cases, and I would have been able to have a look at them. But unfortunately, they were excluded from the data that I did not collect myself.
I understand. So to create the model, CTs were analyzed and segmented semi-automatically in aortic neck morphology. Is this step also necessary in the use of the model now that it is quote unquote finished? Surely this is quite cumbersome and it hinders potentially implementation of the model in clinical practice.
Yeah, I agree that at this point in time, it's a little bit limited to now transfer it immediately into clinical practice. Because indeed, also for a new patient, you would need a 3D model from the CT scan, and then you would very quickly be able to obtain these shape information by the statistical shape model. But I think with the rise of artificial intelligence now and all the methods that are coming out and are being developed to automatically segment 3D models, this might not be such an issue in the coming years. But for now, it's a semi-automatic process. Yes.
So it is still a step that's necessary to use the model.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
A detailed anatomic evaluation of aortic neck morphology was performed of all included CTs using four principal component scores on the cranial, lateral, and anterior posterior views. Can you explain to us what these principal components are and how they were determined?
Yeah, I think this is still always a little bit hard for people to understand, like, what does a statistical shape model output look like and how can we interpret it? I always try to think about it as comparing apples with pears. So you have like different shapes, different colors, different structures. And if you would try to see or capture what the variation is, you would have these features such as shape or length or color. So you would have sometimes green apples, but also green pears, but also the structure of how it feels a little bit different. And you can also apply that information to 3D shapes. So what statistical shape model actually does is it tries to estimate where the biggest anatomical variation is and tries to capture those features that are related to one another into one or two principal components. And then it's up to the clinician or the anatomical expert to interpret these output because it's only a mathematical output, right? So you need to that translation still. The problem or what currently happens and what I'm also tend to do is to look at these principal components and correlate them or interpret them as the anatomical neck characteristics as we know them. So neck length or diameter or angulation. But actually it's more an interplay of these factors. So that's the main benefit of using a statistical shape model because it combines these characteristics that could not be envisioned by solely looking at them separately.
Yeah, I think that's a very key point, what you've pointed out there, that actually this is the main thing, that the benefit that such a model brings is interplay between those main characteristics that we would classically use to look at an aortic neck, and giving us really much more valuable information.
Yeah, because that was not actually really pointed out in this study, but we did a study before this one where we actually combined the output of the SSM with the conventional measurements as we know them and also compare them to those separate models. And then we actually saw that there's more discriminative ability if you would combine both features. So there's also more or less intuitively, you can see, okay, there is something within a statistical shape model that provides additional information that we could not only capture with the conventional measurements as we know them.
We'll be sure to link to that article that you've referenced to in our show notes below, so do check that out. Okay, so based on these principal component scores, five classification models were tested. The models are called gradient boosting, random forest, K nearest neighbors, logistic regression, and support vector machine. In your results, the gradient boosting model is reportedly the best of these models. Can you summarize and explain the results that have shown this model to be superior to the others?
I think it's good to mention here that even though we highlighted the one with the highest area under the receiver operating characteristics curve, that's actually a value that you would use to compare different models because it's independent of sensitivity and specificity. But the point is that the model performances were quite similar. So even though we highlighted the one with the highest ROC value, I think that all these models, except for the support vector machine, did a little bit less performance, but the others were quite similar. And I think that also was indicated, that's why we used a statistical method, the DeLonge test, to see if there was a statistical difference, and there was not. So we tried to also mention it in the discussion section that even though gradient boosting had the highest value, it does not mean that the others are not, well, good enough or not predictive enough to be used. I would not say that they are useless.
How are we to interpret this? Are you saying that in the future, potentially one of the other models is going to come out as the winner, or in the future, we still need to be doing all of the models?
I think, and that's already a little bit thinking in the near future, what we also been working on and what I would change or what I would improve is maybe make an ensemble model out of these five, because then you will get the best out of both worlds. Because sometimes, in some cases, the other model performs better, and in other cases, it's another model. And I think that it will always be the case. It just depends on what patient or what case you're looking at. And I think what I would have done differently, what I would improve by this, and also for interpretation purposes, is that we should not focus on one specific model, but we should maybe make an ensemble of all these models.
Am I hearing you say that you're working on a better model in the future and the best is yet to come?
Well, that's actually the goal, right? I mean, this was really a first step to see if we could use this preoperative shape information. And this study, in our opinion, showed that we could, but we also know that there are other factors that might be important, and also the black box feature now, because it's a binary output, we would like to extend that to a sol value and maybe even predict a surface, the apposition surface itself. So yes, we are obviously, as a researcher, because I'm still doing research, we are always thinking about the next steps, and to see what else is out there we could use. There's a lot going on.
Interesting. So back to the basics. So all of the preoperative CTs were then tested using the model that were created, using this chosen gradient boosting model and predicting the apposition lengths to be above or below 10 millimeters. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. And I think I would like to add on that we only looked at the first postoperative CTA. So I think that's something, we also know that apposition might decrease over time, and that's something that we did not take into account in this study.
Interesting, yeah, good point. Out of this, the main result, and thus the performance of the chosen model, was measured that 77.6% of patients were correctly classified with a sensitivity of 0.7, specificity of 0.79. In other words, 70% correctly predicted insufficient apposition below 10 millimeters, and 79% correctly predicted sufficient apposition above 10 millimeters. Now, this result is based on the CTs of the same patients who were included to create the model. Isn't that right? Wouldn't validation be required using new, different sets of patients to test the models? Or maybe this is something ongoing and coming soon.
Well, the short answer is it's yes. Yeah, we did not externally validate the model within this study, but that's actually something every model should be done. So even though our start setup was that we use leave-one-out cross-validation, meaning that we train the model based on N-1 patients, and then we tested the performance on the left-out one, and we did that, we repeated that for all patients. But still, one would need external validation, also include other medical centers, because there might also be a difference there. And I think, yeah, that's something that we would like to implement as well.
So along the same line of thinking, is there going to be a prospective testing of this model? Perhaps it might even become unethical one day to place the standard EVAR in patients where your model has predicted a high risk of short apposition.
Yeah, that's a valid argument. And I was thinking that prospective testing might be a little bit too far from this model. I think there needs to be brought to a different kind of model, because it's too black box. I think a surgeon would not go or change the preoperative planning based on whether or not this model says, well, 0 or 1 output. Like you have less or more than at the millimeter apposition. I think it would be way more valuable to see where is the apposition predicted, and what does that imply for future. Like, such models are always an addition to the current preoperative planning ways. It's never a replacement of. And I think prospective testing in this case might not be what we need. I think we need to present clinically interpretable models by clinicians to see what will happen, and based on shape information. I'm not really sure if prospective testing is something that we would want to do, because the point is the data that we use were already biased by the decision that was made, right? We use the standard EVAR patient, so the surgeon already made a decision to treat this patient with standard EVAR. And I think that we do not have sufficient data yet to see for new patients, okay, this model says that we should do maybe open surgical repair or a complex EVAR, because we did not take that into account in this data set yet. So I don't think that prospective testing at this point in time is something we should aim for, but we should rather expand the model with more interpretable results like cell values or surfaces, and we should extend the data set with patients that were treated with other type of EVAR, like complex or open surgical repair.
Interesting. So this kind of feeds into my next question quite well. Do we feel that the results of the model right now are good enough? Like, do we have any comparative data to see how well it performs compared to experienced surgeons or radiologists, for example, who may already be finding these high-risk patients for endoleaks and be treating them differently with FEVARs or CHEVARs or open repair as we speak?
Yeah, I think experienced surgeons, they have knowledge and skills and experience that they already know which factors or which parameters, which measurements combined together might result in a good or less desired outcome. And I think this could be used as an extra formation tool to see, okay, well, in some cases, we definitely see that the apposition was not enough. And then we also know from these patients that they developed a type 1 anal leak. So I think we should set up other studies to see what would the surgeon do based on the results and what would our model say, and then compare these results. But these are all future studies, yes. But I do think cases that are predicted to have not enough apposition are already the cases that are very tricky. And I think that it's something that's already known to the surgeons. I think it should also be noted that we only look at shape information here, and there are way more other factors that influence whether or not a specific treatment should be aimed for. And that's something that we did not take into account. So that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to say, okay, you should take this model, and then you absolutely know that and you will not have sufficient apposition. I think other factors are also very important.
Right. And those factors is information that is available to the deciding physician.
Exactly. Yes.
Fair enough. Yeah. Thank you for that reply. I imagine that many research teams are looking to your work and also trying to incorporate artificial intelligence into improving their research in the aortic and in other vascular fields. In your personal opinion, what's the biggest hurdle in bringing this field of science into the modern day clinical practice?
Yes, that's a really general question, I think, right? We all know that, well, the development of AI models in healthcare are really increasing over the last years. And I think there are also quite some good models developed with big data set. But I believe that a main hurdle in safe clinical implementation is in the Netherlands, we have this medical device regulation and software tools. They need to comply with those regulations, and they are there for a reason. But it's not that easy to have safe implementation of these models into clinical practice due to ethical issues, like you already mentioned before, but also the explainability for clinicians. I think there is really a field where the clinician is eventually the end user, right? They need to use this information to be able to understand this, to make informed decisions for treatment planning or diagnosis. You have all these kind of different applications, of course. That would be the main hurdle, but I think there's also a chance due to a rise of technical physicians within the university medical centers, but also the biomedical engineers as myself, that if we have a close collaboration with those technical experts and clinicians, that we can take the next step into develop explainable models which comply with the medical device regulations. And then we can take the next step to actually use them for clinical problems.
Okay, so if I summarize correctly, you're saying that two of the main problems, and they're kind of interlinked, is the explainability of the outputs of the models for clinicians, and the second one would be the regulations.
Yes, but also I think the digital twin technology is a little bit related to that. That if you, I'm only looking at shape, for example, but there are always all these other factors, clinical factors, biochemical factors, device design of, there are all these different aspects that are related to a desired outcome. There's this rise of all these models, but I think we also need to integrate them all together. And I think that's also not that easy. But in the coming years, I foresee that these steps will be taken.
Thank you for that little look into the future and your valuable insights and explanations of this research. Dr. van Velthuizen, I just want to say thank you again for joining this podcast today and for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about the research.
For our listeners, we recommend, as always, that you check out the complete article, for which we will place a direct link in the show notes, along with other quoted and relevant papers for this podcast. Just a reminder, this paper is from the November edition of the European Journal of Vascular and Endovascular Surgery and is open access for all. That brings today's episodes to a close. More discussions on key papers, new guidelines, and other vascular podcasts are coming up soon. In the meantime, please follow us on LinkedIn, X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram to stay updated on new releases. We wish you all a great day. Talk to you again soon. Goodbye.